My text is taken from the first of those two readings, 1 Timothy 4:16. Take heed to yourself and to your teaching. Take heed to yourself and to your teaching. One of the key words in education today is appraisal. Everyone seems to have to be appraised. And a lot of a head's time and work is taken up sorting out this problem, assessing whether pupils and staff measure up to their potential. Of course, the problem arises with the head himself, who assesses the assessor. As far as I know, no such system exists for the clergy or for Christian leaders. I never remember my vicar, exactly three times my age when I joined him, making any sort of attempt to assess or appraise my work, how many visits I made, how many people I'd seen, how much reading I was doing, and so on. It's what vicars are supposed to do, and bishops are supposed to do the same thing for vicars. But don't ask me who's meant to do it for the bishops. Qui custodet custodes. But however that may be, Paul, in his letter to Timothy, lays down certain criteria by which Christian leaders, and I'm not just thinking of the ordained ministry, how they may be assessed and, if necessary, improved. And it seems to fall into two categories, the man and the message. First, the man. Take heed to yourself. The Christian leader of a church, a class, a house group, is to be an example to all in what he says and in what he is, in word and in manner of life. In Safeways these days, you can pick up and eat a small cube of cheese. It's a sample. And of course the idea is that if you like it, you want more of the same thing. You want to know where it comes from and the secret of its particular flavor. Many of us here this evening would, in a small way, call ourselves leaders in the work of this church, All Saints. Whether we ascend this pulpit or not doesn't matter. What sort of advertisement are we to those we lead? Our children, our younger brothers and sisters, the people we teach at school, the people we meet in the office. What sort of an advertisement are we for our Master, Jesus Christ? Looking at us, listening to us, what sort of an impression do they get of him? Do they want more or less? Do they like what they taste? Very often it seems to me that Christians divide themselves into two different kinds. The first I'll call the coffee pot Christians, long-faced, solemn, inclined to be censorious, wonderfully loyal and sound, but they lack charm. They're always anxious to help others, but you can sometimes tell those who have been helped by the hunted expression on their faces. They're full of truth, but there's not much grace. Overflowing with petrol, they are short of oil. The others are what I call the teapot Christians. They're cheerful, friendly, approachable, inclined perhaps to be a little easygoing. They don't like to be critical, and always try to see the best in people. This sort of Christian makes it his business as St. Paul says, to be all things to all men, that he may by all means save some. He may hate football, but he asks all the right questions of the person who enjoys it, so that he can win the confidence of the enthusiast. A friend of mine, who's no sort of footballer, used to study the results each weekend so that he could talk about it to those he was trying to lead who were keen on the game. It doesn't take much to make the teapot Christian laugh. It's always just below the surface. Not a great boisterous, raucous laugh like a train going through a tunnel, but with that deep, heartwarming chuckle from within. Ask yourself, which of those two would you prefer to have leading your house group? Which, if you saw him approaching your bed in hospital, would immediately make you pretend to be asleep? Which, when they make Andrew Corns a bishop, would you like the PCC to choose as his successor? Take heed to yourself. Then we must turn to the message. Take heed, says Paul, to yourself and to the doctrine, to the teaching. What's he thinking of here? I think he has three things in mind. First, we must digest truth. Then we must defend it. And finally, we must declare it. The Authorized Version uses the old-fashioned word meditate. Meditate, says St. Paul, upon these things. The New English Bible puts it like this: make these matters your business and your absorbing interest. But I love that word meditate, just as the cow ruminates, enjoying all over again the meal that it's just eaten. So must we do the same thing mentally with the great truths of the Bible. Feed on him in your hearts by faith with thanksgiving. Like Mary, we must keep all these things in our heart and ponder them. I wonder whether you enjoy pondering the mysteries and the majesty of our faith. I find what helps me to do this is to see spiritual truths reflected in nature, science, sport, history, and so on. To develop a sort of double vision, to take a clairvoyant view of life. Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. I've just finished writing a little booklet called Sermons and Soda. The chief purpose of it is to explain the art of sermon illustration. But I've also tried to show the value of learning to look at things which are temporal and to see the things that are eternal. I put a number on the table at the back there, if any of you like to take one and drop 75p into the little pot. 75p unsigned. We must digest the truth. Secondly, we must defend it. It has been and always will be under attack. It was so in the days of Jesus. It had to fight on two separate fronts. There were the Sadducees, who wanted to extract those supernatural elements which they didn't like, such as the resurrection. And there were the Pharisees, who wanted to add a host of unnecessary items which they thought should be believed. Things haven't changed at all, have they? Their successors are still with us today. The radicals want the gospel shorn of such inconveniently supernatural doctrines as the virgin birth and the ascension. While on the other hand, the ritualists want us to take on board such things as prayers for the dead, transubstantiation, and so on. To take heed to the doctrine must mean a willingness to defend it against attacks from these two extremes and from any other quarter. And thank God for these African, Indian, South American bishops who are putting up such a splendid fight for traditional truth. We who for so long in this country have been the great exporters of Christianity, and now I believe having to learn how to import it from the southern hemisphere. Yes, we must defend our faith stoutly and firmly, remembering those who in the past have defended it with their lives, but at the same time as graciously and lovingly as we know how. Finally, we must declare the truth, making it known, not only by the example of our lives, but with our lips as well. St. Paul tells us that this is to be done in two ways, exhortation and teaching. Our twin targets, he seems to be saying, must be the heart and the head. The first target must always be the heart, head, or the mind. When Philip approached the Ethiopian eunuch on the road to Gaza, he didn't say to him, have you repented, or do you believe? No, he said, do you understand what you're reading? And the good Christian leader, whether he rules over a diocese or a Sunday school class, must make it his primary business to explain the truth so simply that a child can understand. That's why we're told that Jesus never spoke without a parable. He appealed not to the reason, but to the imagination. And that was why the common people heard him gladly. They were able to say, I see what you mean. But we must remember this. To explain something simply, we've got to understand it profoundly. So our first task is to explain, to turn the ear into an eye, so that people will say, oh, I see. Our second task is to exhort, and this means that we appeal to the heart, the conscience, and the will, so that people say, not just, I see, but I must do something about what I hear. This was the response, you remember, to Simon Peter's sermon. Men and brethren, they said, what must we do? Self-assessment, self-appraisal is a difficult and perhaps even impossible task. And I think we all need those who will help us to keep up to the mark in the areas that I've indicated, and perhaps we clergy most of all. It's very easy, you know, to suppose that this pulpit puts you 6 feet above criticism. But we must be ready to detect and improve habits or mannerisms, gestures or expressions which irritate people. But unless you have a very frank and observant wife or a very candid friend, it's easy to get away with these things. So don't hesitate to point these things out to us, whether we're taking a service, whether we're preaching, whether we're leading a house group or what. If it's done tactfully, sensibly, no one can take offense. Don't be as blunt as my old bishop was, who said to his sister, he told me his sister wouldn't speak to him for a year because he told her that her husband mewed like a cat in the pulpit. It was perfectly true, the poor dear man did, but it should have been possible to have found a kinder metaphor. And I was curate for a short time to a man who said his father-in-law sounded like a wounded cow in the pulpit. Again, he was absolutely right, but fortunately he didn't say it to the man himself. But it's interesting how often that little phrase, one another, comes in the New Testament. We're to exhort one another. We're to love one another. We're to pray for one another. We're to serve one another. And so I believe that not least of our duties should be the desire to see the leadership in this, our church of All Saints Crowborough, to see the leadership at every level as high as it can possibly be made. That's all.